Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanity and Social Sciences.
This week, we're going to be discussing a paper by Dr. Matteo Salonia. Matteo is an assistant professor in the School of International Studies. Previously, he taught at the University of Liverpool, Manchester Metropolitan University, and King's College London.
At UNNC, Matteo teaches European and international history with a specialism in the history of the Iberian world, and he co-leads the research cluster on global, imperial, and transnational histories. In fact, he was teaching this morning, as I understand it.
I was.
He published the book Genoa's Freedom, Entrepreneurship, Republicanism, and the Spanish Atlantic in 2017, and co-edited the book Travel Writings on Asia, Curiosity, Identities, and Knowledge Across the East, circa 1200 to the present in 2022.
His paper that we'll be discussing today is titled Biblical Kingship, Catholic Theology, and the Rights of Indians in the Opening of La Casa's Short Account, and was published in September 2023. So, Derek, how did you find this one? I sort of feel that my knowledge of Columbus and the Castilian conquistadors, well, I realized I was kind of sadly lacking in this department, shall we say.
Yeah, actually, it's really interesting. You know, my doctoral work was on First Nations loanwords in early Canadian literatures.
I did not know that.
Well, now you know.
What?
And this particular paper was very, very different. So I specialized narrowly in the Canadian Indigenous experience and settler contacts, mostly in the 19th century. So this predates that significantly. And of course, I'm familiar with Columbus's legacy and some of the knock-on effects. But I found this really fascinating because this was a whole different worldview. Because in Canada, it was, of course, the British and the French who were the settlers, and this was the Spanish.
By Columbus's legacy, what do you mean by that? Because for me, that means learning about Christopher Columbus in school in the UK. But I think you're talking about a bit more in depth than that.
Yeah, there's currently anti-Columbus days.
Did not know that.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Is that in America or?
Mostly in America. We don't revere Columbus at all in Canada. He's not considered kind of major figure in the same way. There's a lot of pushback anyway. The idea of discovering a place where millions of people already live is kind of strange to me. I discovered China, right? I came across it and,
oh yeah,
there were some people here, but
yeah.
You know.
There were people here? Really?
There were more than a few, yeah. So it's a very strange kind of perspective to talk about Columbus discovering the New World. And there's a lot of pushback, actually. So I had a t-shirt in university that just said, Columbus was lost.
I'd like one of those, actually.
I think we should print one out for you.
Definitely, definitely. But that means ultimately that this paper must have been quite different for you in this regards, because here what I'm seeing is this actual kind of critique of a critique of Columbus, in a sense.
Yeah, very much so. I found it fascinating. And actually, I don't want to talk too much about it because we have the author here.
We do.
So we should ask Matteo all about this paper. And maybe he can jump in.
Maybe he can.
And tell us about the topic and the main argument of this particular paper.
Welcome, Matteo. Please do go ahead. Tell us about your paper.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me here. Well, if you ask me about the main argument, I feel like one of my students in one of our seminars, right? The reading is assigned. Please tell us about the main argument. It's a bit, but it's a legitimate question, right? What is the main argument here? What am I trying to do here? I think that I will pick up from your observation, right? That Columbus, or rather than Columbus, let's say the political consequences of his voyages have come under heavy criticisms, right, recently. And one of the things that this article shows is that we may not be the first ones to criticize some of the consequences of Columbus' voyages. And in fact, very early on, we see instances of self-criticism. We see the development for the first time of an array of arguments that are anti-imperialist. They're anti-imperialist arguments. And arguments that, being then articulated in different directions, may give rise to a system of international law where different peoples have rights, including the right to property and self-government, regardless of their race or their ethnicity or religious faith. And so that is a bit of what I'm trying to show here, that this tradition that was developed in the West, a tradition of you may call it human rights, has actually roots that go far deeper than the Enlightenment. And I don't remember if in the text I use the expression Enlightenment myth, but surely one of the things I'm trying to do here is to show that we are all within this bubble, right? Every culture has its own bubble, its own way of looking at the world and looking at the past and looking at the future. And what is our own bubble in modernity is surely this myth that the Enlightenment has brought a clean and neat break between us and whatever existed before the Enlightenment that was supposedly dark and quite savage. And in reality, many of the arguments developed during the Enlightenment originate from reflections that have to do with things that we are not that familiar with, such as canon law, which is the law of the church, or debates during the first stages of European empire building under the Spanish crown.
Okay. I'm actually wondering if we might have to wind that back a little bit for our particularly Chinese listeners, but also for me.
Yeah. I could give a context, right? I can give a bit of a context.
Yes.
Would you like that?
I would love that. Thank you, Matteo.
Okay. And of course, the audience here is mostly our students. Am I right?
I'll also be listening.
Yeah. Okay. So let me try to give a context for Las Casas, for this character that dominates my article. And then if I'm going too far, you can stop me. If I'm not being clear, you can interrupt me. Or if I'm being redundant as well, you can interrupt me. So the context for this is the early phases of empire building in the Spanish Atlantic. So the origins of the Spanish Empire. And we need to remember or to realize that there wasn't a plan. There wasn't a plan. Columbus didn't cross the ocean with a clear blueprint of what he was going to do. And surely what he imagined that he will do was not building an empire. What he wanted to do was to reach the Great Khan in Cathay, where he wanted to reach Japan and China. He had promised the Spanish monarchs that he will find a way to the east by going west. And contrary to the evaluation of his plan by pretty much all of the experts, Queen Isabella, at the very last moment, changed her mind, called him back to court, and accepted to help him. And so the plan was not to conquer. It was to establish a sort of factory, a commercial outpost in one of the great cities of China, of which Columbus had read about in Marco Polo, places like Hangzhou. He promised the king and queen that he could set up a factory where goods could be exchanged, and quickly Spain will turn out to be the richest kingdom in Europe. Now, the end objective of Columbus is not so much to wage war in a new world that he doesn't imagine, but rather to wage war against the Muslims in Jerusalem. That is his final objective. His final objective is to enrich the kingdom of Spain, the kingdoms of Spain, so much that they will launch a new crusade to liberate Jerusalem. And it is something very odd for us, but Columbus was literally on the other side of the globe, and all he could think of was Jerusalem, because he's convinced that if Jerusalem can be liberated from the Muslims, that will usher in the end of the world. And he sees himself as the great player in this divine plan. I know that this sounds odd to us, it sounds very alien to us, but we have to remember that in 1453, the Ottoman Muslims have conquered Constantinople. That was a shock for all of Christendom. And these are sort of like the consequences in the psychology and in the political psychology of people at the Spanish court and within Columbus' own mind. So that was the original plan. It's not really a plan that has anything to do with the Americas because they don't know about the Americas. Now, once the Americas are discovered, the context is that Columbus is absolutely convinced he has reached Asia. You know, this is just a misunderstanding. This must be some islands that are not very much civilized, that are not very much advanced as the economies of China and Japan. If he can only go beyond these islands, Japan is surely behind the corner, right?
Where specifically did he land?
1492, and then he continues with four more voyages, and he is trying to map the Caribbean Sea, and then he touches the mainland. But we have to imagine that the work of Columbus and of the entire generation after him is a bit as if we turn off the lights in a room and we have no idea where we are, and we try to touch the walls and the objects to make a mental map. So when we see the profile of the American continent, we see the whole American continent, right? But Columbus would not have seen that. He would have seen emptiness and then a few islands here and there. So he's convinced that there must be a passage. He can go through this obstacle that he has found, and China must be just behind the corner. Right. He initially
he wasn't wrong.
He wasn't that
he just
wrong,
had a
right?
Scale
it's just
a little
that
off.
He had, yeah, that was the reason precisely why the experts had rejected his plan, because they say, what? His calculation about the size of the earth are ridiculous. It's not, he promised that basically Japan will be where more or less the Caribbean, right? So that was his estimate. So Columbus has received the privilege of governing these islands. Pretty quickly, the monarchs realize that Columbus is a great navigator, because he is, and he is as stubborn as hell, but he's not good at administering an island. He's not good at governing, and especially let's remember that he's a Genoese with a Portuguese background. The Spanish are very proud people. The Castilians are very proud people. They don't understand why they should take order from this little funny guy with a weird accent. They don't like Columbus. They don't like his orders. Initially, he tries to give orders, even to the extent of protecting the so-called Indians.
Can right? I just so, ask about sure. the various empires that you're referring to here?
Yeah.
Because you're talking about Genoa, you're talking about Spain, you're talking about Castellan.
Yeah. So, sorry. So, Spain is the modern country that we have in mind, right? And it was originally a composite monarchy, and this monarchy gets put together, the kingdoms composing this monarchy are put together, at least the major ones, precisely in this generation, with the marriage between Queen Isabella, who's the Queen of Castile, and King Ferdinand, who's the King of Aragon, which is itself a composite monarchy. So I say Spain, you know, for shorthand, like, but yeah. And Isabella is a decisive character here, because she shares a lot of Columbus' vision and cosmovision. She is convinced that she also has a role to play in the history of salvation. That's why she's so friendly with Columbus. And when Columbus at some point is shipped back to Spain in chains by one of the royal officers, she's the one who frees him up. Because as I was saying, it appears pretty soon that Columbus is not a good administrator. So the administration of the colonies, or what are to be developed at this point as colonies, is taken away from him.
He was shipped back in chains?
That
I didn't
happened,
know that.
That happened when the officer who is sent for the first time to take jurisdictional powers away from Columbus reaches Hispaniola, which is the main site where they were starting to settle. And he arrests Columbus and some of his other men, and he ships them back in chain for the entire voyage. Columbus is in chain. And then when he reaches Spain, and some of the officers realize there that he's been brought back in these conditions, they tell him, okay, you can take off the chains. And apparently he refuses to do so that he can more spectacularly show him his suffering in front of the king and queen, and kind of like shame, put them to shame. Look at considering what I've done for you, look at how am I being treated, you know?
They really missed this bit out in my school, I have to say.
Yeah. Continue. So one of the things that Columbus early on was trying to do was actually to protect the so-called Indians. So he had left orders to his men not to interact with them and not to take their property. But of course, they disregard his orders. And interestingly, when he comes back and finds the bunch of Spaniards whom he had left behind killed, he's not quick to judgment. And he understands that they must have done something, right, to deserve the reaction from the locals. But this is not to say that then later on Columbus will not do something. I will get to that in a second. But the point is that Already in the letter that he writes to the king and queen, you see the movement, right? There was initially the objective, finding China, establishing trade. And in the letter, he says, well, I sort of tried, you know, I'm trying to find large city with wealthy market. But, you know, in the meantime, let me tell you how fertile and how beautiful the land is and how easy it will be to sow it and to... So you see where he's going. He's moving the objective from a trading enterprise to settlement. And this is what happens. Now, there are a couple of problems to complete the context, right? Before getting to the reaction from some churchmen and from Las Casas in particular. The problem is that, as I said, at the beginning, there was not a plan. Now you have a bunch of Spanish who have heard about these islands and who joined the settlement at Hispaniola. And they didn't leave their families, their homes, their villages, cross the ocean, risk their lives, seen some of their friends dying in the crossing, to then become farmers. So yeah, I always try to have my students sympathize with kind of like both sides, right? The way they see it is that they did all of that because they heard that there was easy wealth and quick wealth. So they want their gold. But there is not enough gold. So Columbus at some point wraps up a few of the bad Indians, such as those who were more militarily aggressive, and he ships them back to Spain as slaves to be sold. And Queen Isabella initially says, okay, but after a few days, she feels a remorse. She feels sorry for that. And she has second thoughts because she thinks, wait a minute, these are the same people that Columbus had written to me saying that they were the best people on earth, that they were very peaceful. Am I sure that I can actually sell them without endangering my immortal soul? That's the point. And in 1498, I think I mentioned this in the article, or 1500, she forbids the enslavement of Indians unless in a just war. Now, of course, how are you going to define a just war, right? But it's interesting. Nevertheless, it's interesting that because it shows, okay, so you cannot just... Does that mean that these people have actually some rights, right? So are they recognized as subjects, meaning like as a Castilian subject or an Aragonese subject or a Genoese subject, because Columbus was born in Genoa in Italy. So option A, gold, is not viable. Option B, slaves, is not viable. Although some bands of Spanish continue to enslave Indians at the outskirts, right, where royal officers are not watching and churchmen are not present. They keep enslaving. The core of the colony, the first two options for settlement are gone. They're gone. And so this is the context to understand the encomienda, which is the only difficult word, I guess, in the paper. The encomienda is a compromise. It means an allotment of Indians. It's basically a group of Indians who remain nominally free. They are not slaves. They are entrusted to one of the first conquistadors of that region. And they have to pay tribute to him. They have to grow food for him, go into the mine and dig some gold. That depends on the region, right? Because then this institution spreads out even after the conquest of the Aztec Empire and the Inca Empire. But it is based on reciprocity. And again, we have to understand the problems and why this is a solution that on paper is great. It's just that in practice, it's a disaster. But on paper, it's a great solution because Indians will not be enslaved. The problem of these hotheads, of these Spaniards going around and not settling down will be solved because you can only get an encomienda, a group of Indians, if you become a vecino, the citizen of a town, and you settle down. And so the interest of the crown is to replicate Spanish civilization, Spanish civility and society on the other side of the Atlantic. And the Indians themselves are going to benefit under this scheme because they will not be enslaved and they will learn Christianity from the encomendero. So from the individual Spanish guy to whom they have to pay tribute. Now, on paper, it's a fantastic solution because it solves all of these different problems. But in reality, it's an utter disaster because number one, these people crossing the ocean are not the best and brightest of Spanish society.
Or Christian.
They're not the best and brightest Christians. They have not received any religious instruction. They are not interested in giving religious instruction. And all they care is to become señores, so to be served rather than serving as it was back home. So they will work their Indians very often to death. They will overwork them. They will mistreat them. And it's very difficult to say what's the difference between the encomienda and slavery. That's the background. And when the first missionaries come in particular in the 1510s, bunch of Dominican friars, the Dominicans are a Catholic religious order established in the 13th century. In the 13th century, we have the two great religious orders, the Franciscans established by St. Francis of Assisi, who dedicate themselves to poverty, utter poverty and the service of the poor. And then you have the Dominicans who instead dedicate themselves to studies. They are usually university professors and to preaching. This first group of Dominicans comes in and they realize that the last thought in the minds of the royal government and of the encomenderos, of these guys having these groups of Indians, is saving the souls of the Indians. That's the last thing that they are caring about. And this is the beginning of the great debate when one of these Dominicans on the Sunday before Christmas of 1511 goes up the podium of the church to give the preaching, and he accuses all of the elite of the nascent colonial society of being, in his words, worse than Mohammedans, because they
are enslaving,
he's basically telling them that they're going to hell because of the mistreatment of the Indians. And therefore he storms out of the church, which means that he refuses to complete the mass and to give them communion. This is very important in the argument of my paper, because what I'm trying to say is that the origin of human rights discourses is not secular. It is imbued with religious motives. And you see this from the start. It is framed in this context of seeing, right, the mistreatment of Indians is a mortal sin. The abuses, the violence, the massacres, or even simply the daily mistreatment of these people is due ultimately to a spiritual flaw, to not being able to follow the example of Christ. And so if you realize that, then the whole argument that is being built by these Dominican friars, and then who later build this coalition on the two sides of the Atlantic Ocean, is an anti-imperialist political campaign rooted in a Christian understanding of human nature. So if every human being is made in the image and likeness of God, and if these Indians whom we have encountered are indeed human beings, therefore they are also made in the image and likeness of God, therefore they have dominion, which is a word which means a right to private property and a right to self-government as well. That's why in the article I go on to mention Francisco de Vitoria, who never went to the Americas. He was a professor at Salamanca, the best school in the best university in Spain. And during his lecture, he stands up and he basically dismantles the titles of conquest of his own kingdom. And the king wasn't amused by that. But there was really this feeling in the 1530s that the enemies of the empire within Spain, especially this coalition of churchmen, is winning the argument. Somebody has smuggled some letters about describing what has happened in the colonies to Rome, and Pope Paul III is aware of this, and he comes out strongly saying that the Indians, as far as he has heard, are intelligent. If they are intelligent, they can grasp the truths of the faith. If they can grasp the truths of the faith, then they should not be despoiled. They should not be, their property should not be stolen. They should not be mistreated. And let's remember that the whole title of legitimacy upon which the Spanish Empire is being built is based on religious ground, that the monarchs are going to teach the faith and take care and do justice as they are supposed to be doing as good Christian kings. So the implications of saying, actually, let me tell you what's going on there. There is no justice. There is no spreading of the faith. There is just exploitation. The implications of that are that somebody else can say, oh, really? Okay, then the title is void. I come in and I establish a colony there. You see, so that's why the crown cares about these arguments being put out. And so this was the context for Las Casas.
I find this absolutely fascinating to listen to. And I feel like it goes back to what Derek and I were saying just at the beginning, which is sort of how fascinating and mind-blowing in many ways we found kind of this paper and the main argument in it. At one point you talk in the paper about how you say that this kind of, you call it Christian universalism and Catholic philosophy, has never been adequately acknowledged as to the extent to which it contributed to this sort of emerging human rights discourse. Hence, I don't know about this, and hence a lot of our listeners won't know about this angle. Now, why hasn't this been acknowledged? Why isn't it part of this history?
Well, the Enlightenment has created its own myth, which is sort of secular religion, a sort of secular faith. This faith has some tenets which include human rights, but the problem is that the justifications and what is the philosophical structure behind this is very flimsy. Now, as part of this mythology, of course, religion is reshaped as a category that doesn't contribute to the improvement of society, which is the main objective usually of Enlightenment reflection. And I don't want to trash the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment itself is a very pivotal movement in world history, of course. But the issue is that many of the assumptions that you see in Enlightenment writers, where are they coming from, right? The assumption that there should be something like international law. There is already an assumption, right? Where is that coming? The assumption that there is a moral law and that it can be known by all peoples in the world, regardless of their race or background, right? Where's that assumption coming from? And it surely isn't coming from the Enlightenment itself. It's been inherited. For example, just give you an example, right? One of the founders of the Enlightenment is considered to be John Locke. And very few people know that John Locke, besides writing his most famous political treatises, has also written a book on the reasonableness of Christianity. Now, that shows a link and a sort of continuity that in history textbooks is usually lost. So I see the Enlightenment as yet another reform movement. When Christians see that there's something wrong in the world, the symbolism of the cross, which is basically telling you, look, the victims should be elevated. The ones who are oppressed should win in the end. That pushes Christians to these movements of reform that you see since the early medieval period, and that end up actually in the Enlightenment, that is a sort of secularized form of reform. That's one answer to your question. Another answer is that a person like Las Casas, so explosive in his rhetoric, we're going to get to him, I promise. His book, especially a book like the Short Account of the Destruction of the Indies, was easily seized by the geopolitical enemies of Spain. And so the Northern European, the Protestant propaganda machine against Spain produced the Black Legend. And therefore, paradoxically, the fact that the person initiating the Black Legend is himself a Spanish, like Las Casas, who was born in Seville, and who is criticizing his own empire, is sort of like lost in the conversation, whereas the image of the Black Legend remains. And the Black Legend is such not because the building of the Spanish Empire didn't involve massacres and injustices. Of course it does. That's what we are talking about, right? So that's exactly what we're talking about. But the Black Legend involves the idea that Spain was especially unique in its kind of like cruelty or in the barbarous nature, in the backward nature of its imperial project, whereas Northern European countries, and among them England, of course, will build an empire that is much more enlightened, it brings prosperity, and it is less unjust. So all of that rhetoric of modernity as associated to the Northern Atlantic, which tends to cut out the fact that before, you know, 200 years before the British Atlantic existed, there was already an Iberian Atlantic, also contributes to the answer to your question.
So I'm going to pick up on the rhetoric, because one of the things that always stands out to me in these kind of studies is how you use your terms, right? So in Canada, presently, I don't think you would be able to use the term Indian
in
this
course.
Way.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, Native Americans or Amerindians. Yeah.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And so I realize it's as an historian, what you're doing is you're referring back. But I just want to be careful for the listeners as well to realize that this term is being used within a particular context and referring to how other people referred to these peoples in what became called the Indies, and now we would call the Caribbean, I would guess. Anyway, I just wanted to flag that.
Yeah, of course. The reason will be that before Columbus' voyage, the lens beyond Christendom and beyond the lens of Islam. So those kind of sketchily known areas that went roughly from Egypt all the way to Katai, China, they weren't really known well by Europeans, and they were falling under the generic term the Indies, plural. So the Indies were these lands that Europeans were aware of, but they had such little information about, especially after the disintegration of the Mongol empires, the Mongol order. And so it is kind of made sense for Columbus, if he was really convinced, as he was, that he had just hit, you know, a corner of Asia, that he would call those people Indians. So it wasn't a derogatory term in that historical context. It was kind of like a matter of fact term. It is only after the continent's shape emerges, clearly people realize, wait, this is not Asia. This is someplace else that we had no idea that it existed. Then they start to call these places the Americas, but it's a bit too late because the name Indians has stuck, especially in some of the Spanish writings. And interestingly, Las Casas, who is trying to defend the Indians himself, he uses the term and he wraps up the Indians into this category of Indians, even though the diversity of their customs, of their cultures, of their languages is incredible. And he's aware of that. But in a book like this, in a little pamphlet like this, in the short account of the destruction of the Indies, he's not aiming for accuracy. This is a political campaign. He wants to shake consciences, to accuse, to name names, and to have immediate change in the legislation of the empire. So,
and Canada was guilty of this too, right? So we have the Indian Act and things like that, which, you know,
it's a name that stuck,
That's right, But it is a bizarre term because, as you say, it's being used for a kind of pan-native idea or First Peoples. And it's, you know, we see this a lot here where you have Asian, right? And how useful is that term as a kind of blanket category? It's very, you know, Asian culture, how does that encapsulate anything when you have a diversity within, you know, and the same with the native peoples of not just North America, but South America and the Caribbean.
Yeah. And it's interesting, I find, when you're kind of talking about the idea that this pamphlet is not supposed to be accurate. It is a form of political propaganda, because sort of I feel that when I'm reading it, I want to critique it as being sort of Orientalist, basically, and as kind of not being accurate or not trying to be accurate in this sense. But I suppose it's so important to actually remember that he has an agenda here, and it is a worthwhile agenda in many ways. So there was a section when you talk about the idea of these people, the Indian people, being sort of innocent and pure and everything, and trying to almost construct them as sort of Christ-like in this way, that sort of made me feel very uncomfortable. And I just kind of dislike that, this sort of, but it makes sense when you talk about it as being an early form of human rights discourse, almost, you say, and an early form of Western self-criticism. And I haven't really seen that in such a context before, and particularly not within this religious context. And I am very interested, again, going back to sort of my original question, which you answered really well before, which is kind of, why isn't this more known about? In a sense, is there a political agenda as regards not knowing about that?
Well, that's a difficult question, you know. I think that we went through different phases of memory, right, and of memory construction. And a person like Las Casas, when Spain and Europe were more self-confident and assertive of their identity, would be inconvenient because of what he says, right? He's criticizing Spain and Spanish history. He's demolishing the idea, of Spain as a bringer of civilization. And then later on, as we enter a phase, which we are right now, of harsher criticisms, and in some sense also ahistorical criticisms, because it's kind of like presentist to accuse Columbus of all of the things that he's been accused of recently. It's sort of like a passing a value judgment using our own standards right now, which doesn't mean, I mean, the other extreme would be moral relativism, right? But there ought to be sort of like some place in between where we consider his worldview, such as the one that I sketched earlier, right? Initially, he wasn't interested in conquest. He was thinking about Jerusalem. He was going the opposite direction of what he was interested in. So you ought to know and to appreciate these facts, right? And now maybe the figure of Las Casas could be inconvenient for other reasons, because he's clearly showing that it's not us as 21st century, you know, technologically advanced and enlightened people who criticize Columbus and the conquest for the first time, but actually in the space of a generation, people were already criticizing so harshly the project of settlement of the Americas, and they were doing that in Spain. So they were interestingly, the crown doesn't use censorship against Las Casas. Las Casas is continuously being heard at court. He gets very close, especially to Charles V, who is the grandson of Isabella and Ferdinand, and would become also the Holy Roman Emperor. He picks up a huge amount of crowns. And this, we have to take spiritual forces seriously in history. This is something I try to explain to my students. Even if you don't believe in something, that doesn't mean that people in the past didn't believe in something. And evidently, some of these monarchs at some point were deeply bothered by what people like Las Casas were saying. And they call him up. They say, well, what is that really happening? And then they are confused, right? Because they also have the representatives at court of the rapidly developing colonial elite who say, no, don't listen to these friars. He doesn't know anything. He's a liar. He's not reliable. These Indians are not a sort of kind of like subhumans. If left alone, they will commit horrible crimes. They are cannibals and so on. And so very often you see the monarch being genuinely confused and calling up a commission of experts and saying, okay, guys, you sit down, you listen to these two sides and let me have your response. Like, what should I do here? What should I do here? So one of the things I explain in the article is that these pamphlets, which is definitely political propaganda, I mean, he talks about thousands upon thousands of millions of people being killed. And, you know, so he definitely exaggerates the level of violence and how many deaths were caused by the Spanish. But he never intended to give an accurate account. That's not his point. His point is to save as soon as possible as many lives and souls as he can. That's what he wants to do. That's his objective. And so as a consequence of Las Casas, of Bartolomé de Las Casas campaigning in 1542, the Leyes Nuevas, the new laws, are approved. And the new laws abolish the encomienda system that I told you about earlier, which is incredible, because put yourself in the shoes of the colonies. They think, we are being betrayed. We're being betrayed, especially the first ones to enter a region who had fought maybe, or, you know, maybe their brother had died. Who knows? They think, what? I'm being reduced to poverty once again, because if the encomienda is taken away from me, what am I going to eat? And I cannot pass it on to my son. What is he going to? I'm not going to leave him with anything, which is why in Peru, you have a civil war. The representative of the king in Peru, when reading these new laws, is attacked. His head is cut by the rebellious Spanish colonists and is paraded around Peru. And there is a civil war that goes on for a few years. So this is serious business. This is serious business because these people have nothing to lose at that point. They've got nothing to lose. If these new laws are applied, they've got nothing to lose. So Bartolomé de Las Casas is just one of the characters involved in this political campaign to protect the Indians, the so-called Indians. But he is the subject of this article because I'm looking at one of his pamphlets. And interestingly, Las Casas himself had been an encomendero. He had probably participated in some slaving expeditions as well when he first arrived in the so-called New World in 1502. And he was probably sitting in the church when that first Dominican friar I told you about in 1511 accused all of the colonists and stormed out of the church. And at that time, he hated the guy. But then he had a change of heart. There was something bothering his conscience, and he came to realize that the true interpretation of the gospel and of the Christian life could not be compatible with the violence and the forced labor placed upon the Indians. So he freed the Native Americans assigned to him, and he became a Dominican. And it's not, and the guy is incredible, because this guy not only wrote pamphlets and visited the court so many times, but he even tried to convince the king repeatedly to run an experiment. The experiment will be something like this. You declare a certain area of the coast of Venezuela where there aren't settlements anymore. You declare that off limits. So nobody can go there, except the people I say, which will of course be other friars like me and some carefully selected farmers who are honest workers brought over from Castile, from Spain. So nobody should be allowed to even talk with the local inhabitants, with the natives, before I arrive there. And it's incredible because he is able to convince the king to do that and to finance the expedition. It's incredible. So he's got all of these papers where the king says, okay, everybody is forbidden from entering there. Bartolomé de las Casas is in charge of who can enter. Nobody can use any violence unless he says so. Oh, that issue of enslaving Indians in the case of a just war, that's going to be evaluated by las Casas in this. And it's like, we're talking about hundreds of miles of coast. So the guy is he's flamboyant. He, you know, one of those people who have more ideas than they can express. The experiment is a complete disaster. It's a complete disaster because there are months of navigation between Spain and the New World. By the time he gets there, he arrives at the moment in which a punitive armada is leaving from Hispaniola to go precisely to that area to kill and enslave as many Indians as possible. Why? Because in his absence, some of those natives had killed a couple of friars. And that was used as an excuse by the colonists in Hispaniola to say, okay, that's good. We're going to launch a punitive, this is a just war, so we're going to enslave as many Indians as possible. And so, you know, his plan of having the first contact, he seeks the first contact to show this is how a Christian looks like, not
when
like those. Right?
When I'm listening to you, Mateo, yeah. This sounds absolutely chaotic.
It is.
Oh, completely. And it goes back to what you were saying before about the idea that these people did not have a plan. No.
Yeah.
And the whole way that this movement has been taught to me is that this was a machine. Colonialism was a machine. It was well-oiled. It was designed to do this, etc. And the way that you describe this from your research is that mm-hmm. this is almost the complete opposite, mm-hmm. shall we say.
Well, there's a great book by Matthew Restall. I think it's called The Seven Myths of the Spanish Conquest. It's out with Oxford, I think University Press. And he's looking at some of these seven myths. And one of the myths is that Spain had an army. There was no army. There were different groups of people who autonomously organized an expedition and that sought legitimacy from the crown in exchange for something. Very often these bands will disassemble if they had not been successful and reassemble. They will be led by charismatic figures such as Cortés in Mexico and the Pizarro brothers in Peru. And there was a lot of infighting, usually along regional lines, like within Castile, like our group comes from Extremadura, so we're kind of like, we're brothers, right? We got here first, you know, we get the gold. When we split the natives, we get more, you get less, something like that if you arrive later. So it's chaotic, it's total chaos. And Las Casas is not afraid of jumping into this. So it's not just working at court, he's not an intellectual, like some of the other people in this coalition, right? As I told you earlier, there's Francisco de Vitoria, who never even left Spain, right? And he's denouncing the Spanish conquest. He's using the principle of occupatio, for example. Derek, at the beginning, was mentioning the fact, well, how could Columbus discover anything, right? Even that argument was used in the 16th century by Francisco de Vitoria, another Dominican, the one who teaches at the University of Salamanca. And he uses the principle of occupatio, which was an old law in Rome that tried to explain how property starts. How is it possible that people use property, right? And the Romans came up with the idea that, well, you know, when you shoot a board in the sky and it falls down, that's yours. Or if you find something on the ground, it's yours. And some of the conquistadors were saying, well, we've got a right to be here because we discovered the place. And Vittoria and the other Dominicans in Spain were saying, actually, no, because due to the same principle of occupatio, somebody was already there. We have read accounts that say that these people have a language, have magistrates, have institutions, have marriages, have laws, have markets. Therefore, they are rational. Therefore, they exercise the right to occupatio before you. So the famous argument against Columbus that is so widespread today is actually itself quite old.
The other sort of myth that you seem to be shooting down here is the one that I often see in depictions of colonialists, which is often that they are really smart, in essence. And you sort of see this in Southeast Asia very much. You walk around a sort of colonial graveyard and, you know, everybody died by about 20 or 21, in essence, you know. And it's true that you're not going to send the best and brightest around the world to die from malaria and get killed by natives and all the rest of it. So you send kind of, you know, the fifth or the sixth son, in essence, out there. So it seems to be also kind of dismantling this myth that these people in some way, you mentioned they were charismatic, but these
some
aren't the, yeah, but these aren't the best and the brightest, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are really quite impressive, like Cortez and very daring, very brave. I mean, you could say that they are very brave if they jump into, you know, an environment that they know nothing about with a, you know, with a few swords and a cannon, and they take over an empire of millions. But even there, then there is the other myth that's been shattered by Matthew Restall and other historians, which is the fact that these Spanish small expeditions don't really conquer an empire of millions by themselves. What they do is that they find indigenous allies. That's why the Spanish are happy to find large empires to fight against. Because within an empire, you will find discontent. You will find indigenous people who hate the Aztecs, for example, and who side with you, and who will guide you through the territory that you don't know. That's exactly what happens. So, yeah. But definitely, going back to the issue of like most of these people, well, they are not good in the sense that they are not, well, they're not bright, or they're not interested in showing a good example of Christian behavior. And Las Casas, in his pamphlet, uses that to bother the conscience, right? I mean, if you are a Christian and you read these, you are so bothered by the fact that he uses the word Christian all the time. He uses the word Christian to say, you know, due to the violence of Christians, such and such amount of people died in this place. The ill treatment by these other Christians here, why doesn't he use the word Spanish? Why doesn't he use the word, you know, in some instances he says, those pretending to be Christians, which is the real meaning, right, behind what he's trying to say. But again, this goes back to the worst kind of accusation that you could move against his enemies. And also it goes, there are strings attached, because he's alluding to the fact that if the king in Spain doesn't do something about this, he also isn't a good Christian.
On the subject of charisma, I'm sensing your huge enthusiasm when talking about this subject very much. How did you get into this?
So, mostly by teaching, I think. So, my research, I'm not one of those academics who spend, like, say, half of their career on a specific subject. Not that there is anything wrong with that, but I like to jump around quite a lot. However, many of my interests or writings or research outputs are linked by the thread of the Iberian world, so Portugal and Spain. My book on Genoa shows the alliance between Genoa and the Spanish Empire. And recently, since 2019, I've written several articles on early Portuguese Asia. I got articles on the Journal of Maritime History or Cambridge Itinerario that discuss the beginnings of the Portuguese presence and the Spanish presence in Asia. So there is a thread, right? I have an interest in Iberian studies. But specifically about this topic of Las Casas, I guess this comes from my conversations with my students, both at King's College and here, because we read this text together and we try to unpack it together. And we try to see why does it start in that weird way. And you've seen that I talk about this in my article. I say, okay, you will expect it to start, I don't know, with a little bit of history, talking about Columbus, or I don't know, a bit of background. And instead, he starts with this biblical definition of what is a good king. And we're thinking, why are you talking about that?
In that way, the paper must have gone through a few incarnations.
Yeah, it's these are thoughts that came from conversations with students and from exchanges with students, both in the seminars and say in office hours when they were talking to me about their papers. Or, you know, so I have thought about this for a long time. What is Las Casas trying to do? Because he's more famous for the very graphic and shocking depictions of violence in the central part of the pamphlet. But I was interested in this, in the frame of the pamphlet, and why there are all of these Christian themes there. And these Christian themes show that the origin of these rights discourses, this sort of very first seeds of human rights discourses, embedded within a Christian framework, within Catholic philosophy, the idea that, okay, all of men and women are created in the image of God, therefore they have dignity, therefore you need a very strong excuse, a very strong reason before using violence or, you know, and therefore there is a very early instance of anti-imperialist criticism. So, because sometimes people who know about Las Casas focus, oh wow, he's so exaggerated, he's so flamboyant, he's so graphic. He tried to kind of force his readers to be empathetic, to be sympathetic, you know, towards the victims here. Whereas what I'm trying to say is, okay, yeah, there is all of that, but there is also this Christian framework that you need to consider. You cannot just file him away as somebody who uses graphic depictions of violence. There is this notion of human dignity that is related to his Christian understanding of the world. And for example, he uses other Christian ideas like biblical idea of kingship, how a king should behave. He uses that to blackmail the king, say, hey, do you know how a good king should behave in this and that way? So let me tell you about what's happening. You know, I mean, there is an implication there that if he doesn't do something, then maybe he's not a legitimate king, right?
There was some interesting rhetoric that got put together in North America where they were talking about the native peoples as potentially being one of the lost tribes of Israel. Mm-hmm. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of that when you put this into a frame, you know, you say at the beginning, he portrays the Indians here as virtuous pagans, peaceful, and in fact, almost angelic beings. And that seems to resonate with a kind of Rousseauian noble savage idea as well. Any comments on that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what he's doing here. He is describing Native Americans as a sort of Adamitic race before the fall. And he's going to such extent, and again, he's not trying to give an accurate account, because as I say in the article, what he says is ridiculous. And it's not only ridiculous from a philosophical perspective, like there can't be human beings like that, but it's also ridiculous historically, because by this time, the Spanish have met so many Indian polities, so-called Indian polities, like so many Native American political orders who also commit injustices, right? I mean, they've met the Aztec Empire with its system of tributes and human sacrifices. They've met the Inca Empire with a very heavy system of extraction of labor as tribute, which the Spanish, by the way, are happy to find, because then they can just decapitate the structure and take advantage of it. But the idea that these native tribes or native kingdoms or native empires are completely uninterested in worldly power, like he describes them, they don't know any strife or any jealousy. It's totally preposterous. But again, it serves an objective, and the objective is to then introduce into this idyllic landscape the evil Spanish who arrive and who have all of those characteristics flipped upside down. So where the natives are uninterested in worldly power, the Spanish have a hunger for power. Where the natives are half naked, or anyway, they are so generous in giving things to their guests, and they're poor, right? They're characterized as poor, even though, I mean, in those very sophisticated civilizations that the Spanish have met on the mainland, you can't really say that they're poor, right? But nevertheless, he wraps all of them together and says they're poor. There is not so much an economic condition in the pamphlet as a moral condition. He's hinting at they're poor, like Christ was poor, right? They're poor, like the church is supposed to be poor in the context of the Counter-Reformation against the Protestant criticism of church corruption. So you see what he's doing. He's pulling all these things together and he's building this image of the Native Americans on the one hand, and then he introduces into the picture this disruptive force of the Spaniards, who are the most horrible beings that you could introduce into this environment. It's like a virus. They're like a virus, really. And he generalizes, of course, about what they do and what, you know, how they behave. He doesn't make for any exception. There is no nuance here, right? It's not like every Spaniard arriving in the Americas was really drenching his hands in blood. It's not like that. And he knows that. But he doesn't care.
There are so many different threads going on here. Listening to you talk, though, and having read the paper, I feel there is a strong potential to elicit critique here, and maybe quite sort of obvious strands of critique in some ways. I'm interested in, has there been any reaction to this? What is the general reaction when you do try sort of and create or further this narrative?
So, two reactions. I think, well, not reactions to this paper in particular, because it just came out, but it's, I can tell you, you know, if I were to make this argument, and I have colleagues who have read my paper, I have, like, my former supervisor at Liverpool who was very interested in this. I think that there is a gap between scholars of the Iberian world who know about this, who are aware of this, and scholars who are not very familiar with documents from the pre-Enlightenment period, and scholars who have written about, like, broad histories of human rights. They make their histories usually start off with the Enlightenment, or even when they don't do so, they don't really acknowledge the contribution of Christian universalism to some of the assumptions that Enlightenment writers themselves hold, right?
Is that because of the sort of secular nature of a lot of the societies the scholars come from? I think so.
But for scholars who are specialized in the Iberian world, this is quite. I mean, they know about Las Casas is so famous. They know about this, and they know about the great reaction from this coalition of churchmen. They know that the Pope Paul III wrote the famous bull, and that, you know, at the universities in Spain, the Dominicans were a force to be reckoned with. Las Casas was able to, I told you earlier, the crown wasn't using censorship against Las Casas. Las Casas was able to use censorship against some of his enemies. The Dominicans are able to influence royal policy and to say, that guy I know, he's about to publish that book who mocks me, off. There's a guy who wrote an early history of the conquest, and he was kind of siding more with the colonists and making fun of Las Casas' wild plans for peaceful colonization, for peaceful encounter. And Las Casas heard of that, and that book has not been published until the middle of the 19th century. So, like, just to give you an idea, this guy had friends. So there is this broad coalition, and scholars of Iberian studies, of Iberian history, of Spanish history, they're very much aware of that. But there is this big gap between them and those scholars who, especially, maybe they don't read Spanish, or they are not very familiar with pre-Enlightenment documents, or they have a more of a secularist stance, as I say in the article. And so they think that the development of the idea of human rights, as much as it has unfolded, is due to the fact that we have distanced ourselves from the category of religion, right? So to bring back the category of religion and tell them, look, actually, maybe some of the assumptions during the Enlightenment had already been articulated by people like Franciscan friars or Dominican friars, will make their chronology, so their ordering of the invention of human rights, crash down.
I can see that you're expressing some frustration there, maybe, with your field. Yeah. What would you hope to achieve from this paper? What would you hope it would begin?
I hope that not just people who are coming from Iberian studies or from Spanish studies will read this. So I hope that people who are not familiar with Las Casas will read this. People who are not familiar with the early stage of Spanish imperialism would read this. That is my hope. So that is one of the reasons why I inserted this term of human rights as one of the key words, and I use it sparingly throughout the article, even though usually, you know.
So that was a very tactical decision.
Yeah, I mean, scholars of the Iberian world don't usually use, I suppose, this phrase of human rights, because that's seen as a very modern and or contemporary expression. So, but because, to answer your question, I hope that people who come from a different field will take note of this. That's why I inserted that language. I'm trying to say, look, I know that these are not human rights in the sense that we intend, for example, for the 18th century, right? But the arguments that are here constitute a backbone for the ones that come later. And this is a very important precedent. From here, you have the Black Legend against Spain, therefore the British and North European criticism towards certain forms of imperialism. Then from there you have the idea of an international law where there are different polities that have different rooms for maneuver, let's say, like the different space of action, rights, right? Regardless of race or ethnicity or religious beliefs. And then from there you have, you know, a discussion of, for example, the sea, like the freedom of navigation, and all of these issues emerge already from the 16th century in Spain.
So what's next?
What's next? I suppose what's next is, I don't really plan to write in the short term again about Las Casas or about this, but I am definitely interested in writing about encounters and also writing about maybe even earlier encounters with the Indies, as we have called them. So before Columbus, say in the 14th century, I am now looking at some texts from churchmen who traveled to the Indies, to Asia, in the 14th century. And the reason why I'm looking at them is that I would like to see a different perspective from the one of Marco Polo, who is usually the most cited, because Marco Polo, of course, is a merchant. He has a certain view of things. And I would like to see how are churchmen, not unlike Las Casas, say two centuries before Las Casas, how are they interacting with peoples who don't fall under the category of Christian, Muslim, or Jew? That's what we're talking about here, right? That's the main question. How do we classify these people, right? And if we classify them as human beings just like us before receiving the gospel, then actually they have the right to hear the gospel. They have the right not to be molested. And they are potential Christians. And if they're potential Christians, they cannot be enslaved unless there is a just cause and blah, 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 and all of that, right? So there are all of these consequences. So I'm very interested to see how earlier instances of encounter and earlier accounts of encounter produced by churchmen classify peoples, in this case of Asia. In the generation right after Marco Polo, there are two or three churchmen who traveled to the East, and I'm reading right now their accounts. So it's not about the Americas, it's not about Las Casas, but there is a thread there that you can see that I'm interested in.
Thank you, Matteo. Well, I do hope that you'll come back when you publish your next really exciting research project and share it with us. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me. I hope this was interesting.
Thank you very much. It'd be fascinating, yes.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty's home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.